Mental Health Monday Marathon with Mick Coyle on Radio City Talk.
It's a Monday. It's the Mental Health Monday Marathon. This is the biggest ever broadcast of its kind in the world ever when it comes to mental health. We're talking about people who have been affected by negative mental health. We've been talking to people who work within the field. And this hour, we're spending a little bit of time, apart from with Harry from McFly, with people who've served in the armed forces. And we're going to hear about what life is like on Civvy Street, some of the issues that come with that one. Now, joining us in the studio now, we have Jay Wheeler, who's ex-forces, served in Afghanistan. And also Andy Grant, former Royal Marine. Andy, it's great to see you. Thank you for your time. Jay, great to see you. Thanks both of you for coming on. Can I bring up the phrase Civvy Street? Because that's often the phrase which gets used when people talk about leaving the armed forces. Andy, what did the return to Civvy Street mean to you?
For me, I had a pretty strange transition as a normal, because I think for me it was probably slightly easier because I was injured, as in I lost my leg. There was months, probably 18 months, where I was spending a bit of time in Liverpool, a bit of time back in Headley Court, the rehabilitation centre. So it wasn't as if, I think for a lot of people, you go serving, whether you do 5, 10, 15 years, and on the Friday, it's your last day, Monday morning, you wake up in Civvy Street. So I think for me, it was probably slightly easier in a sense that I was spending a lot of time at home and then maybe back in hospital, back in rehab. So I'd say personally, I mean, obviously I had to deal with losing the leg, but as in just going from military one day, civilian the next, I'd say I'd probably had it slightly easier than most.
Jay, Civvy Street, what does it mean to you?
I mean, for me, I didn't really kind of, it wasn't my choice to go into Civvy Street. I was medically discharged. So up to, you know, 6 months up to that point of being diagnosed with PTSD, I mean, I had to make the transition whilst also being really ill at the same time. Which I think just kind of made my whole situation greater than what it was. But some people say, now, you know, would you go back to the army? And I say, well, no, I wouldn't. But I don't regret the 15 years that I did. It's the outcome that's quite sad about it. You know,
I was going to say, because you served in the armed forces, you had a good stint in the armed forces as well. You left though, and suddenly your mental health took a really big hit as a result of that. Did that leave you? You've kind of suggested there that you know you don't hold any grudges towards the armed forces, but did it leave you thinking, oh, that wasn't quite the way things were supposed to go? That wasn't going to be leave the armed forces and then move on with my life with something else.
No, I mean, I can't speak for others, but I know my own personal case. Like, I felt really let down by the army from the initial psychotherapist coming out to see me and kind of diagnosing me and stuff. That was it. And I didn't, for a whole year, I didn't have no comms with the army whatsoever. And they'd put me on the sixth from 2012 to 2013. So 2 weeks prior to the date that I was officially, I received a letter, and that was it, thanking me for my service. And it just made me really angry. And because then the PTSD just kind of came out at its worst, I became very angry. I became angry with the army, with the government, with people in general. Yeah, I was very angry.
How did your post-traumatic stress disorder then play out in terms of your life and what life was like day to day?
My first incident was I'd gone home early on Christmas leave, and I'd been doing this job for about 5 months after returning back from Afghanistan, and it was just within a few days, and I just started feeling guilty. I felt guilty for being alive, to be honest with you. And I just felt sad for what I'd seen through society's eyes, you know. And I went over to this church across the road from me, and I went up there and I said, God, you know I believe in you, but I need your help now because I'm feeling something's going drastically wrong. Because I was having suicidal thoughts at the time. I remember I went back home and I sat down on a couch, and within 5 minutes I was like, I don't think he heard me, you know. So I went back over to that church and I was screaming. And you know, I didn't care. I was just screaming and saying, I need your help because I've tried everything else and it ain't working. And then I went back home, and within an hour of being home, I took masses and masses of pills that I'd just accumulated through around my apartment and with the intention of not waking up. And at that time, you know, my close friends were really concerned about me and stuff, so they were kind of trying to keep an eye on me, and it just got to a point where I just ignored everybody. I would leave. The only time I would leave my apartment would be like 2 o'clock in the morning when it's dark and when there's very little chance that you're going to come across someone, and it's just like from mine to the garage to get some ciggies or something like that. I then started accumulating loads of rubbish, like massive bags of rubbish. I started weeing in milk bottles. I was hoarding masses and masses of these bottles with my own urine in it. And I was living literally on the couch, and I'd taken the overdoses. I'd cut my wrists. I'd done a lot of stuff on this couch. There was flies around the apartment, and I just didn't want to be alive. And for every day that I was alive, I kind of went against what my body was telling me, and thought, well, if I can't take my life by taking these pills, then I'll cut my wrist, I just won't eat and I'll starve. And there was a period where I just got to a stage where I could only drink water, and it was all by accident that I got help, because someone had got into the apartment block where I live, and they kind of got into my apartment, broke in, and the door wasn't really 100% secure because the police had to bash it down a couple of times due to the overdoses and stuff. So when the police came to investigate the burglary, they were like, you know, what's going on here? And I was like, well, never mind what's going on here. Like, I've been burgled. So even at that point, because I didn't allow anyone to come to my home ever, but at that point I knew I had to phone the police, and at the same time I knew that now someone's going to walk through this door and see exactly how I have been living. And the fact that I knew some guy walked into mine and stole, it was the fact that he came in and saw how I was living. That's what bothered me most. Not the fact that he'd stolen stuff, but the fact that this was the first person that saw I was living. And the police were fantastic. They got in touch with Safa. And from that moment on, Safa got involved, and Safa have been absolutely outstanding. They're just there, you know, and that's the only, they're a military charity, but bless them, they don't get a massive budget, but what they did for me, they helped me get my home back to being a home, and that was through funding it, and they had to apply for loads of funding and stuff. But the first day, my caseworker, Bill Hunt, he came and he said, came through the door, and he's an ex-RSM. He's a volunteer for SAFA now. And he came through the door and he said it was the worst thing he'd ever seen in his whole entire life. But he said to me, you pick a bag and I'll pick a bag and we'll take it down. And I said, no. So he went away and came back again the next day or so, and he said, let's take it back. And, in the end, he'd done me adding that much. I just went, all right, let's take it back down. And it all started from there. But it was just a massive, massive change to not wanting to be alive and not wanting to be a part of this society. And I just given up. I've given up on myself. I've given up on everybody. Given up on people that I love. Just, I didn't care. And I think that's a sad thing about PTSD, because it does put you in a situation where, I mean, I live on my own, so I think it's even worse if you are on your own, because you only seem to answer your own questions, and that's not always a good thing, you know. But with the help of, I've got a CPN now, I've still got my SAFA caseworker, I've got a fantastic doctor, I've got positive people in my life, and it's just going from strength to strength. So I've got to mention it. I've got a lovely dog. I've had a dog for the last year. Her name's Fudge, and she's a rescue dog. I got her from Freshfields Rescue Centre. And having Fudge, a part of my life now, she's therapy from that. She's got it. And you know, up until that point of having the first breakdown, I was really into fitness and stuff throughout my army and all that. But when I had the breakdown for the last couple of years, I've done no fitness, you know, couldn't care less. But since having my dog, Fudge, my fitness has improved massively.
Jay Wheeler's story on Radio City Talk. Andy, you're listening to that as well. Post-traumatic stress disorder can play out in many different ways. Maybe Jay's one of the more extreme sort of cases. Is that sort of the experience that he's got? Have you heard, you know, former colleagues who've had similar situations or whose lives have been affected by PTSD?
Yeah, just listening to the story, there's definitely a lot of things that resonate within my own life. Maybe not as extreme, but certainly the feeling of, you know, things change. I remember being back from Afghanistan and it was my dad who kind of had the words with me, and I just kind of, I was 19, I got back from Iraq at first, and you walk around the streets of Liverpool again, you know, a few months back you were in Iraq, which for me was a pretty chilled out tour compared to Afghanistan, but still, you're walking around back home wondering, why isn't everyone talking about Iraq? There's a war going on. Why aren't people asking me what's going on? And then my dad kind of said to me in a polite way, he said, Andrew, people have got their own lives, you know, people are, you know, got bills to worry about, got kids in school. Not everyone's concerned about you being in Iraq. And I think that it was a good thing for him to say. It was a good thing for me to hear, because you've got to realise that although it's massively significant for you, what you've been doing on the other side of the world, and you think you're doing for Queen and Country, or, you know, you're doing a good thing, it doesn't affect everyone. And that's a big thing that people in the military need to realise, and that's what I needed to realise at the time. And I think him saying that to me, you know, helped with my transition to not feel that kind of anger, which some people can feel. And I think I was lucky to have my dad there to kind of say to me, you know, don't expect everyone to say to you, you know, well done for what you've done, because people have their own stuff going on.
I spoke to a former squaddie at an event at FACT, actually, who was involved in a project based on the fact that he'd been suffering with PTSD. And I said to him, what for you sums up life on Civvy Street, the question I opened with you guys? And he said, EastEnders. He said, at 8 o'clock at night, everyone goes home and watches EastEnders. He says, for him, when he was in the mess, when he was in the military, 8 o'clock was the fun time. You could have a drink, you could play pool, you could play table football, you could have a game of cat, you could do all the things that would happen. It would all start at 8 o'clock. And he comes out of the military, and at 8 o'clock, everyone goes home and watches EastEnders. And he said he couldn't get his head around the fact that wasn't the moment where people came together, that there was a sense of community, that you could have a laugh and a joke. That was the point where everyone disappeared off to their homes.
That's the thing, I think, for me personally, which I'm, you know, very fortunate I've not suffered from post-traumatic stress. And I do think there is people who have got PTSD from maybe things they've seen and experience they've been in. But I also think, and again, I'm no expert, but I don't know whether you'd class it the same thing as PTSD, but I definitely think there's a transition disorder that maybe gets sometimes misdiagnosed as PTSD, because, again, touching on what you said then, that's the transition. You know, you're going from, the example I always use is you wake up in the morning, you go for a run, you're running with the lads, you come back, you have a shower, standing in a shower block next to the lads, you're getting dressed next to the lads, you go for breakfast next to the lads, you go to work next to the lads, you'd have your lunch next to the lads, you're in a classroom next to the lads, and then all of a sudden you might wake up on Civvy Street and you're working for yourself, or you're working in an office where no one goes on a run together to start the day, and, you know, you don't all stand there, you know, naked in the shower together, you don't all go and eat your breakfast together, not everyone's best friends. And even I think that transition can play a massive part. And it's, I look at my life, I went from, you know, being 20, you know, living for the weekend, young bootneck, travelling up to Scotland every weekend, not a care in the world. You know, 18 months later, I had a girlfriend, two stepchildren, a mortgage, one leg, no career. And it was a big change. And that transition, I think, can cause just as many problems as maybe some of the experiences you've had on the battlefield.
For the work you do now, you do motivational speaking. Was there a moment where you thought, right, you know what, my experience that I've had within the military, even though I've come through it, you know, lost a leg as a result of it, I've had something which I can, you know, talk about. I've had a positive. I can summarise those events as a positive thing, and I can share that, the best bits, with other people. Was that almost like a relief moment when you realised that you did have something that you could actually, you know, put together in slides and in a presentation?
It started from, I used to go into my old secondary school and just do talks about what life's like in the Marines, what life was like in Iraq and then Afghanistan. And they rang me up one, and it was just me going in really informally, jeans and T-shirt, sharing my experiences. And the school secretary rang me up one day and said, can you come and do another talk? I said, yeah, of course, that's fine. She said, this time, can you wear your uniform and all your medals? And I thought, it's only, you know, 20 minutes with the kids, you know, don't really need all that. And she said, oh no, this time it's in front of 700 people in Bootle Town Hall. And I was like, well, hang on a minute then, this needs a bit more preparation. So I worked with my old English teacher, a good friend of mine, Peter Gall, and we came up with a presentation. And it just coincided that it was 1 week before I was having my leg amputated. So I kind of put the speech together, and it was all about, you know, a new challenge, a new, you know, not letting life kind of bog you down and taking control of your life again and using negatives for a positive experience. And the quote I love is, life is 10% the situation you find yourself in, 90% what you do about it. So the speech was all about me having my leg amputated, going into a new world, and obviously the kids leaving secondary school, going into the big wide world. So we put a speech together, and then at the end of it got a standing ovation, and it felt amazing to know that actually what I've been through has actually been well received. And people came up to me afterwards and said that, you know, it was really good. And so that's how I kind of started it. And what I've tried to do since is just use my experience of what I've been through just to tell a story. And what I've found with my story is, whether it's me talking about losing my mum at a young age, joining the Marines at a young age, Iraq, Afghanistan, whatever it may be, there's sometimes hopefully snippets in there that people can relate to. And that's just been a massive benefit for me. And the thing that's helped me, again, which resonates to the stories you probably hear with mental health all day when I've been listening in, little things for me have been, example, getting a dog. That was another one for me. You know, I do these motivational talks, but, you know, don't be tricked into thinking my life's been, you know, I wake up every day like Mr. Motivator. It's not always the way. You know, my dog was a massive help for me, getting me up in the morning, you know, a little goal to, you know, run 5K, do 10Ks, do marathons. And, you know, loads of little things together have helped, you know, me kind of keep my life on track, if you like, despite obviously the injury in Afghanistan.
We never did a dog's hour, Jake, did we? We could have done that. Next year.
24-hour dog hour.
Actually, it's interesting that people talk about either exercise or they talk about the arts and theatre and things like that as well. Jay, when we were picking up on your story there, we started, or we left you right at kind of rock bottom. It's actually amazing that, you know, rather than doing something through a motivational speech or things like that, it was art. It was graffiti, which was your way back into, you know, a sense of a happy place as well. Yeah. And some would say, you know, want an act of vandalism, but, you know, we'll call it art.
Yeah, we'll call it art for now.
It's street art.
Yes, street art.
Just tell us about love, the word love.
Well, it was when I was admitted to Broad Oak Psychiatric Unit, and I was in there for about 2 months, and the staff there encouraged all service users to, you know, use the OT department and get into art and whatever. So at first I didn't really want to do it, and a couple of days I just said, no, I'm not interested. And on something like the third or fourth day, I was like, okay, let me do something on what is really important to me that I've accumulated since coming back from Afghanistan. I've seen hate when I was in Kosovo, I saw hate when I was in Iraq, and I saw hate when I was in Afghanistan. And then you come home and you put your news on, and there's hate on your own streets, you know, and it's all going wrong. And I just thought, well, love's really important to me. Always has been since I was a little boy. And it just felt like, from what I'd experienced, that as a society, that we were going backwards and we should be going forwards. And I just think, you know, it sounds really corny, but love brings people together, and it really does. So I decided, I got my friend Paul Wilcock, who was working at Broad Oak at the time, and he made me a love stencil, a stencil that says the word love. And the idea was, right, I guess I'll go out and get some spray paint, and I'm going to go around the streets, and I'm going to start spraying this love on the streets of Liverpool. And I started doing it, and I set up social media pages around based on that, and for the last 3 years, it's gone absolutely fantastic. Like, I've won awards for it. I've got to do little presentations to children, which I think is awesome. And I've been crowdfunded to go to Poland. I've been to Poland and Barcelona, and it actually relates with people. This last 6 months, I've been working with a photographer, Karen O'Donnell, and what she does, where I used to go out and take a photo of my work, she now comes out and takes photos of the whole situation, where she catches people actually looking at what I'm doing, and then when I pick it up and walk away, she's catching those reactions from what people are seeing, and I get absolute lovely messages on my social media from people tag me in the love tag and stuff. And I get a lot of personal stories to how people can relate to it. And I think because I've been honest about my mental health, it allows other people to kind of feel, well, if he can talk out, then, yeah, I need to talk to somebody. And that's what it's about.
Absolutely. Jay, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much, Mick, and thank you very much for having me. It's been absolutely brilliant.
If people want to have a look at your stuff online, where can they go?
Go to Love Art Global on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
Andy, people have been following your documentary career. They'll know that you're a man who's into all kinds of things now. What have you got any big challenges set up? What's 2018 got in store for you?
Yeah, so it's got it's going to be big. I've been working with a good friend of mine, Phil Reed, who on a book. So I've got a book coming out in April, May time. That's going to be called You'll Never Walk. So that's giving me a different type of challenge. Thankfully, I've not wrote it. I've got him. He's a much better writer than me, so he's writing it. That'll be out April, May. And I'm also doing the Liverpool Marathon in May as well. Like, sport's been such a huge vehicle for me to, you know, keep on with my recovery. And I just think for mental health as well, it's linked, you know, being outdoors active, it's been huge for me. So the marathon, that's the big one, which I've sadly been starting to train for after a good Christmas. So, yeah, back in January running, and that's the big one in May.
And if you see those little love symbols, you'll know exactly.
Yeah, I'll be taking photos out on my runs on the next
two. Can I just say, Mick, as well, Andy was on about just talking about the book as well. And for the last 6 months, it's really ironic, but the last 6 months I've been working with a lady called Jane Redfern Jones, and we're actually doing a book as well, based on my story. So, yeah, I get that.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I look forward to speaking to you both when those books
Thank
are
you very
out.
Much.
Great to get you on the programme. Thanks Thank for your you. Time. Just coming around to 6:45. It's a Mental Health Monday marathon on Radio City Talk. We're going to speak to some more fantastic organisations talking about mental health in the armed forces next.
Mental Health Monday Marathon, tackling the stigma.
This part of the show is all about mental health in the armed forces. I'm very pleased to say our next guests are in the studio. Brilliant contribution, by the way, from Jay and Andy, Jay Wheeler and Andy Grant. Let's welcome to the programme. We've got Tommy in the studio. Tommy, great to see you. Thank you for your time. Jackie Johnson-Lynch from Tom Harrison House. Jackie, it's great to see you again. Thank you for your time. And from Liverpool veteran Stuart Fitzgerald. Stuart, great to see you.
Thanks
Thank you for
having
your
us,
time.
Mate.
I know you were sort of listening in to Jay and Andy's story. Fascinating story. Did those stories resonate with you? Very different stories in terms of both Jay and Andy's stories, but did they strike a chord with you?
Yeah, they did. I think just listening to, what was his name?
Jay.
Listening to Jay's story there and about how far he's come since then, the first day then policeman walked in his house and seen the way he was living. And how far he's come himself to be sitting here today talking to you. Do you know, it's amazing to see how far he's come.
It is. It is absolutely quite something. And almost when you're listening to him telling the story, you're thinking, how are you going to come back from this? You know, I knew he was in the studio today, of course, and I've met him before. But actually, you listen to the story and you think, how does anyone come back from feeling so low and finding themselves in such a predicament? What's your experiences, first and foremost, within the armed forces?
I served in the Kings for 3.5 years and served in Ireland for 18 months and then came back from Ireland and then went to Hounslow and I left the army then. I left the army and all my troubles seemed to happen after I left. I had a lot of traumatic stuff happening in the family and stuff that I couldn't deal with or talk about. And I ended up in addiction for 20 years. And during the time I was in addiction, I was in and out of prison a lot. I moved away from home. I hadn't seen my mum for something like 17 years. And then when I came through addiction, and then when I came home, it was my birthday and my mum had died. And so I had to go to the funeral parlour and see my mum on my birthday that I hadn't seen her for like 17 years and she died.
Oh, wow.
Through addiction, I'd had a lot of stuff happen to me, like it happened in my life, and it took me away from my family, it took me away from my friends, it had me doing things I didn't want to do. It made me a lonely person and I suffered mentally. Really, wanting to stop and not being able to stop, it's horrible.
Was that, in terms of your experience with the armed forces or leaving the armed forces, was it anything that you saw as a, you know, as a serving member of the armed forces that you think triggered things, or was it about maybe the mindset you had within the armed forces that meant you saw the world in a different way? Or do you think it would have happened to you if you'd have had a job as a plumber or working in an office?
I don't know, really. I don't think so. I don't think so. I just think it was... I struggled a lot when I left the army, like with being able to settle down. I'm moving around a lot, and I think there was no transition. When I come out, there was no help. Like, I couldn't get a flat because I hadn't been on a council list for 12 months and stuff like that. So I was homeless. Not homeless, I was living in my mum's, like, but if she wouldn't let me stay there, I'd have been homeless.
Jackie, you set up Tom Harrison House, presumably... with a view that people like Tommy would need help, that there would be people coming out of the armed forces who would find themselves back on Civvy Street, and that they might find that transition difficult for any number of reasons, be it financial or from a mental health point of view, or 1,001 different reasons as well. I don't want to say any story is typical, because it seems like every story is completely different, but is this the type of story that you hear on a very regular basis?
Yeah, when guys come to us for addiction treatment and they've come out the military, there's kind of like a range of scenarios that come with them. And one of them is poor transition. So often people will leave their family of origin to join something that gives them another family, right? So particularly the army, right? So all three services, but particularly the army. So they get this new family where there's like a culture of banter and camaraderie and brotherhood and sisterhood, and everyone feels like they belong. And there's a lot of drinking in the middle of that, but everyone feels like they belong. And then actually they leave that family to come out into something else, and that something else doesn't actually meet their needs. It's not culturally appropriate for them. Their transition is poor. They don't fit in. Some may come out with kind of combat trauma. Some may come out with kind of other issues around their, like, alcoholism and so on. And so when people come out and the transition is poor, they can often just be left. If they don't get plugged into an appropriate service, then they can often be left. So sometimes we've seen people who've come out the armed forces and gone and lived in the woods. I mean, literally gone and lived in the woods. I mean, I didn't think that was possible, you know, but they have literally gone and lived in the woods. And then other people who've just been part of a transient population, like Tommy was particularly an example of like that, just travelling around everywhere, because after coming away from his mum's through his own addiction for that amount of time, like, he was just transient living around in different places and then in and out of jail, and then coming to us eventually because the set of circumstances in his life, in particularly in Tommy's life and in other guys' life who comes to us, are so difficult that actually they absolutely at that point need help to get their addiction under control.
Was the one thing, Tommy, that you had experience within the armed forces that you were looking for? Jackie there mentioned, you know, that camaraderie, the banter, even the drinking. Was there something which you, when you left the armed forces, were thinking, well, if I still had a bit of that in my life, maybe I wouldn't have struggled so much?
Yeah, I think you never ever find it, I don't think. Well, I never, until I went into treatment, beat around with old soldiers, got ex-veterans, and... I went for 20 years sort of chasing that, looking for that connection. I never ever found it until I landed at THH. And it was the first time, it was just like being back in the barracks. So for me, you know, all the lads come up hugging you and they don't care what you've done or where you've been or anything like that. The only thing that we all had in common is that we were the same. We were all ex-soldiers with addiction problems.
THH, Tom Harrison House, yeah. By the way, for that one as well. You military guys, you love all the lingo, don't you?
I like an abbreviation, don't
absolutely. Stuart, Liverpool veterans, I guess, you know, every, you know, new member of the armed forces signing up are a future veteran.
Absolutely.
Just tell us about the sort of numbers that you'd be dealing with in terms of Liverpool veterans.
So veterans, we've recently rebranded to Veterans HQ this year. We formed as a charity in April 2017. But the project's been around as part of the Breckfield Neighbourhood Council in Anfield since 2010, supporting men and women in the North Everton, North Liverpool area since that time. We tend to, so far, dealt with well over 1,000 men and women. I think one of the key things we have to remember in the Liverpool City region or the North West as a whole has been the biggest recruiting ground for the armed forces since records began. On the back of that, there's now 87,000 veterans in our city region. 87,000. When you say to yourself, well, they're a veteran, they need help. They don't necessarily need help. Recent surveys have indicated that sort of somewhere between 4 and 5% might feel the need to reach out for some support. But 4 or 5% of 85,000 is still 4,500 people. So if we say to ourselves there's 4,000 people out there not reaching out, wanting support from somewhere, missing the camaraderie, the crack and the banter that you get, and the feeling of support from a family that you get in the armed forces, and that's not there for them anymore. The job of Veterans HQ, as we've established ourselves as a charity, is to support those men and women. We have exclusively ex-armed forces men and women supporting those vets themselves. So they're dealing with buddies who've been there, seen it, done it. They're trained buddies. They're trained to give needs assessments before people enter our service as a service user, if you like. And they can talk from a position of strength simply to say, I know what you mean. I've been there. This was my corps. This was my regiment. Here's my story. Bring them up, because you're used to doing that in a team setting. And then start to talk to them about their needs. And we tend to support people with all sorts of different needs. We refer into Tom Harrison House for those who require support with addictions. But we also support people with employment, with welfare, with benefits, with housing. We're working very closely with partners such as the Savini Group. Savini and ourselves have partnered with Liverpool City Council support to redevelop the King's Barracks on Everton Road, which is a sort of 2.5 acre plot. We're going to put some emergency housing on it for vets. We're going to put a veterans centre of excellence in there, delivering the kind of support services people need. And that will be a place for the city region, for all veterans to get the kind of services that they're looking for and the camaraderie that we've spoken of.
I want to make sure that people who are listening to this part of the show who are aware of maybe a friend or a family, maybe it's them who want to find out more information. Jackie, absolutely. If people want to find out more information about Tom Harrison House, mm-hmm. how can they find that information out?
Yeah, they can go straight to Tom Harrison House website, which is tomharrisonhouse.org.uk, or phone us on 0151 909 8481.
0151 909 8481. And Veterans HQ?
VeteransHQ.org.uk is the website. You can find us on Twitter, which is at Elpool Veterans. Or you can call us at the Breck Road headquarters. It's just a small shop front. 0151 263 9878. And ask for anyone. Anybody will help you.
I'll mention all of those numbers again in the next part of the show. Stuart, thank you for your time. Great to see
pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
Jackie, great to see you again. Thank you for your time. Tommy, thank you for sharing your story too. Really thank appreciate you joining us on the programme.
Mental Health Monday Marathon with Mick Coyle on Radio City Talk.